Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 10th, 2006, and this is show number 60. I gotta tell you guys, I am exhausted. I waxed Lindsay's car today, and I had to wash it beforehand because a tree spit all over it, and then I had to wash my car. Had to drive Kyle back and forth to the movies, went to the gym. I am dead tired and it is late. I usually get started recording the podcast around 5 o'clock in the afternoon and it's 8 o'clock. Now, that sounds like not late for the real world, but since I have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning these days to take Kyle to school, it's getting close to my bedtime. I hope it doesn't come out too obvious how exhausted I am. If it is, we'll call this the Sleepy Cast. Well, last week I told you about a fan of the show named Michael Harvey and about his great podcast. He left an audio comment for us and I thought you might enjoy hearing it. Plus, he had a question. Let's listen to Michael.
Hi, Allison. It's Michael Harvey and I just wanted to thank you for giving such a wonderful plug to my podcast, Here's How to Talk on Odd TV at michaelharvey.com. That's Harvey with two E's, on your recent show. I'm so glad you liked Here's How to Talk. I have a lot of fun doing it and recruiting my friends to help with the dialogue. Maybe I can get you to record a few lines for me sometime. Of course, far be it from me to use this audio message just to give a shameless plug to my own podcast, Here's How to Talk on Odd TV at michaelharvey.com. That's Harvey with two E's. I actually have a question for you. I'm looking for a good application launcher for the Mac OS X and was wondering what you used or if you had any recommendations. My dock is so filled up, all the icons look like little mutant M&Ms. I've tried putting aliases and folders on the dock, and that's cleared things up a little, but it's not perfect. Also, I've searched around for a good launcher online, but some of them look as they would be more trouble than they're worth. Thanks for any help you can give me. If you've already covered this in a previous show, just let me know and I'll go look it up. Thanks again for the kind words. I'm certainly going to stay subscribed to the NoSilicast. Now I have to go back to work on my own podcast. Here's How to Talk at an Odd TV at michaelharvey.com. That's Harvey with two E's. Take care, Allison.
I didn't quite catch that URL, Michael. What was it again? Anyway. I love the vision of your teeny little icons in your dock so you can't even recognize them. I do have the perfect solution, and even if I did podcast about it before, I can't even remember if I did, it must have been so long ago, it's worth bringing it up again. Possibly the single best shareware application for the Mac, in my opinion, is called Quicksilver from quicksilver.blacktree.com. Quicksilver allows you to launch an application with a keystroke. The default is to hit Control Space, and up comes a little transparent window thingy, and then you hit the first couple letters of the application name. This sounds a lot more complicated than it really is once you get used to it. After a couple of days, I just simply could not give it up. It drives me crazy to work on a computer that doesn't have it. So you definitely have to check out Quicksilver. You can also use it to find files and folders too, but since I probably have about, 32,547 files on my Mac, that feature doesn't seem that useful to me. There's a lot of features in there that I don't ever use, so you may even find more that you could do with it. One thing I do use it for is looking up people's names in my address book. So let's say I had your name in there. I could hit Control Spacebar and then MIC, and if there were applications that started with MIC, they'd be shown too, but your name would show up in the list. And then I could hit a carriage return and it would instantly start an email to you. If I wanted to look up your phone number, instead of hitting a carriage return, I'd hit the right arrow, and then it would show me a list of the things I could find out about you. If I click down to your phone number or your address, and then I hit a carriage return again, now your phone number or address comes up huge on the screen. That's kind of a feature actually built into the address book, but it works really well with Quicksilver. That's how I always look up people's name and phone numbers. Works really, really well. No doubt, this is the single most useful application you can put on your Mac. Another thing you might not have used much is the Finder sidebar. That's the stuff on the left-hand side of any Finder window, but kind of under the little gray bar. You know, at the top, it shows your mounted volumes, and then below that, it's got a list of things like applications and utilities and a couple other things. Well, it turns out you can drag all of those things out of there if you don't really use them, and they just go poof, goodbye. Better things to put in there are folders you use all the time, or even just a folder you need a lot in 1 week. For example, I always put the folder for this week's podcast in the sidebar, so it's ready for me to dump stuff in there throughout the week. Then when the next week comes around, I just drag it out, and it goes poof, and I drag the new one in there. I should mention that when it goes poof, it doesn't throw the folder away, it just disappears out of the sidebar. You can even put applications in the sidebar for easy access. I use this feature constantly, dragging folders in and out depending on the task of the day of the week. I don't really use it for applications because QuickSilver is so much faster than going all the way back to the Finder and then clicking on an icon. Do let me know if you find either of these features useful, Michael. Last week I reviewed SideNote that gives you a little pop-out window on the side of your screen that allows you to jot down little notes. Pretty capable little application, but I had some trouble with it when I attached it to an external monitor. It seemed to leave a white rectangle blocking part of my external monitor on the right-hand side, which seemed to be related to where it thought it should be based on the size of my smaller laptop screen. If I put my cursor up against the side of the screen, SideNote would jump out but then jump right back in, and I couldn't click on it. I found that if I hovered over the empty white rectangle instead, it would actually work. But I've stopped using SideNote because of that. Got on my nerves. Well, Michael Harvey had trouble with SideNote too. He had performance issues when he would switch identities on his PowerBook. He keeps separate identities for me and day job me. That's an interesting way to organize things. The edge-hugging application he uses a lot these days is iClip from inventive.us/iClip. By the way, that's a capital C in iClip. And it's a $20 shareware clipboard application. Based on his recommendation, I decided to give it a whirl. Hey, I hadn't installed a new application on my Mac in almost 24 hours. I was having withdrawals. Needed something new. iClip installs just like any other application, and it puts a little clip symbol in your menu bar. And when you click on that, it shows the application and has it not hide. You can, of course, make iClip appear and disappear by using QuickSilver, but the easiest way seems to be to hover over the side of your screen. It defaults to the right side, which is my only empty real estate left, so that's where I left it. iClip has clipping sets, which are sets of things that you might want to put together. For example, I created a clipping set called PodFeet, so I could throw things related to the podcast in there. A new clipping set defaults to 8 bins, which are little square boxes in a vertical row. You can set that as you create the clipping set, though. Each bin has 3 symbols next to it, an arrow out, an arrow in, and a little gear symbol. If you have something in the bin and you click the arrow out, it will copy the item out into the clipboard and automatically paste it into your open application wherever your cursor was. That's really useful, I think. If you want a little more control, you can hold down the Option key when you click the arrow out key, and it copies it to your clipboard, but it doesn't do the paste. That way you can go back to the application where you want to put it, place your cursor, and then do a paste. I kind of tend to think ahead, and I know what I'm looking for, so I'm going to use the regular arrow out key. To add things to the bin, you can select text or graphics or a URL and simply drag it into a bin. You can also select the item first, then click the arrow in symbol on the bin where you want to put it. Finally, the little gear symbol is where you can delete the clippings and do other context-based activities. For example, if your clipping is a URL, you'll see open internet address underneath the gear. A much easier way to do that, though, is to just double-click on the bin for the URL you want, and it will launch your default browser and take you right to that address. Another interesting thing to use the bins for is to store file aliases. Let's say you're getting into a file pretty regularly. You could click into a bin, pull down on the gear and select Store File Alias, and then navigate to the file you want to access. Anytime you double-click on that bin, your document will be launched. Might be easier to just drag the file you need to the sidebar of an open Finder window, but then again, you would have to switch to the Finder to launch it, where iClip is always available in all applications. A feature I really like about iClip is that you can hover over a bin and the entire contents of the bin will show up in a quick little window. So it's kind of hard to see what's in it before you hover over it, so that's a really useful feature. You can also put a name for your bin, so the cryptic text or graphics within won't be shown, but a few simple words of your choosing to jog your memory. I noticed one cool thing in the iClip preferences. It has an option to always open iClip in the primary display. If I keep that disabled, I might be able to keep it on my laptop screen and avoid any possible weirdness with the secondary display like I had with SideNote. Then again, maybe iClip won't have the weirdness at all. I'll have to test that soon. iClip looks pretty interesting. You can try it out 10 times for free. Go to inventive.us/iClip with a capital C if you're interested in an easy way to store info at your fingertips. Thanks for the tip, Michael Harvey with two E's. So one of the cool things about real mice, and read real as not a mouse bought from Apple, is the right-click button. This button unleashes a plethora of context-sensitive menus that Mac people can only get to by using a real mouse or by holding down the control button when clicking. This has depressed me deeply, so the fact that I couldn't do it on my trackpad. I've always wanted to be able to do it on the trackpad, but you have to hit control and click on the trackpad. It's kind of a pain. So I was depressed, but imagine my delight when my hero Leo Laporte described a great way around it that's built into the new Intel-based Mac laptops. In System Preferences, if you click on the Keyboard and Mouse Preference pane, you can find some ways to fix this. For your PC folks, a preference pane is the same thing as a control panel. For some reason, Apple used to call them control panels, but they changed the name a few OS revs ago just to confuse us. Anywho, under the keyboard and mouse preference pane, you can choose some nice alterations to the standard installation. Under trackpad gestures, you can select use two fingers to scroll, which is unbelievably awesome. Once you use that, you'll never go back. You can also select to allow horizontal scrolling, which is mildly useful, but it comes up just rarely enough that I do forget to use it. By the way, you can add these features to the older iBooks and PowerBooks by using a hack called iScroll2. Search back in the scroll notes, the scroll notes. Search back in the show notes and you'll be able to find it. I told you I was sleepy. Man. Anyway, back to the whole control click issue. The real fun in this preference pane starts when you select clicking for a trackpad gesture. Basically, this means that you don't have to press down hard on the big button, but rather lightly tap on the trackpad with your finger to select something. Finally, here's the best part. Click the box that says, "Tap trackpad using two fingers for secondary click." Now, if you want those lovely contextual menus, just hit the trackpad with two fingers and up it comes. I love this. It even works inside Parallels on Windows, which is awesome because control click does not work in there. Like I can't right click on my computer in order to go to Explore or to mount a network volume or something. So now I can do it with two fingers. It's funny how a little thing like this will make me so happy. Listener Robert gave me an interesting cross-platform fun tool. It's hard to explain exactly what this is. Kind of one of those things that I think you have to just try it to get it. It's called Last.fm. You download a client for either OS X, Windows, Linux, FreeBSD, and there's even a choice for hardware device or, quote-unquote, I'm using an exotic platform. Kind of wanted to click that, but I tried the OS X installation. The idea of Last.fm is to allow your friends to see what music you're listening to on your computer. I can't tell yet if this is only for iTunes or other players, but it lets you create a playlist for your blog that shows your friends what you're listening to, and it's automatically generated and sorted by how often you've listened to those different artists. The other social networking part of Last.fm is that it will help you find people who match your music tastes based on what you're listening to and what they're listening to. And then maybe if you can see what they're listening to that you weren't listening to, you might find new music through those lists. If you have OS X, you can also get a dashboard widget to track what your friends are listening to right within the dashboard. Here's some hints about how Last.fm works from their website. And I'm quoting straight from them. Once you've signed up and downloaded Last.fm, just listen to music through your computer's music player, as you do every day. The name of each song you play will be automatically sent to our servers and saved in your musical profile. We call this scrobbling, and that's the basis of everything we do at Last.fm, from personalized recommendations to radio, music charts to musical neighbors, and much more. Well, I guess that answers my question about whether it has to be iTunes. Sounds like it doesn't. It's going to be a weird one for me to test, though, because I don't actually listen to music. I don't mean I don't listen often. I mean I don't listen to music. With 3 iPods and an awesome car stereo, it even does DVD audio in Dolby 5.1, I only listen to podcasts about technology. Don't feel sorry for me, and please don't send me music. I've come to peace with this fact, and I've decided to stop worrying about why I'm just a mental defect in this area. The sad thing is that I come from a musically talented family. One of my brothers is actually a professor at the Berklee School of Music in Boston. Oh, well, maybe I just take after my father. Maybe Last.fm will find me people who listen to the same podcasts I do, and I'll find new tech podcasts I like. Not sure that's going to work, but we'll see. The installer for Last.fm scared me. It was 25 meg, and it seemed to put all kinds of stuff in all kinds of obscure places. It was saying, well, I'm putting this here and this there, and I'm going to hide this one in the closet. So this one's really going to be a bear to extract when I'm tired of it. I do need to know how to get rid of stuff once I install it, because if I left every application on there that I install, it would be nuts around here. The Last.fm install also answered a really important question I've been struggling with. Do I actually have fans in my MacBook Pro? In all the time I've had all these problems with heat issues, it occurred to me a few weeks ago that I've never heard the fans kick in. I've even downloaded some little utilities that are supposed to tell me the fan speeds, but they keep saying, no fans found. I was kind of getting worried that they were just like they forgot to plug them in, and that would explain some of the heat issues. Well, while Last.fm was transferring all that slop to my hard disk, one of my processors started cranking, not so much temperature, but just the processor was going nuts, and I suddenly heard the sweet sound of a fan kicking in. Good news. Wish it would kick in a lot sooner, though. I got a line on a little hack that a lot of people have mentioned that I'm going to give a shot, that apparently that's supposed to make me be able to monitor my fans, maybe even control them. That would be cool. Well, I'm sorry to report that after all of this work and Last.fm hiding things all over my disk, the application won't launch on my MacBook Pro under 10.4.7. I went to the forums and found a whole bunch of people on G5s and G4s running 10.4.7, and they can't launch it either. So I went outside and waxed Lindsay's car instead. That's what I wanted to do anyway. If anyone else can run Last.fm and wants to tell us about it, be sure and drop me a line at allison@podfeed.com. My daughter has a 12-inch iBook that's only about a year old, and the other night she tried to copy a gigabyte worth of photos and videos from a recent concert she had attended, only to discover that she had only 300 megabytes of disk space left. I figured I'd just clean up her disk a bit, toss out some unneeded application, she'd be back in business. But it turns out she only has a 30-gigabyte drive, and with 15 gigabytes of photos and movies from her digital camera, and 5 gig of music, which isn't really all that much these days, throw in a few applications and you can see why she doesn't have any disk space left. The bad news is that to swap out the disk on an iBook is just a tad more difficult than a spleen transplant. I've looked at websites that show how to remove the disk, and all it takes is the removal of about 438 screws, cracking the case open without breaking the 17 clips, unplugging 3 connectors, picking up the holy grail on the way. I checked out several external notebook drives first and found out that they were around $120 on the low end for a 60 gig drive and a bit more for an 80 gig drive. I did this in anticipation of calling a place I know that could maybe do this for me because I knew I wasn't up to the complexity of the replacement. So I had Lindsay call this place. It's called Mac 911 in Santa Monica. They've helped me before, so I figured they'd help me now. So she called him up and asked him what it would cost to replace the drive, and they quoted $400 for a 60 gigabyte drive, including labor. Now, I did include the idea of actually transferring my data back, so maybe that was part of the problem. But cripes, For about 2.5 times that, I could get our brand new MacBook for crying out loud. Huh, had to rethink that plan. Can't take too much time, though. Lindsay leaves to go back to college in a week. What am I going to do? Can't spend $400 for a disk. Then I got a brilliant idea that I know a bunch of system administrators, one of whom is awesome with hardware. I asked him if I could pay him instead of the Mac 911 guys, and my buddy Namdar readily agreed. I offered him $100, and he said the last laugh would be on me when I saw how quickly he was able to get the job done. The good news is that Nam just loves hardware, so the chance to see how the iBook is put together sounded great to him. I want to rewind on the broad-based statement I made a month or two ago about how easy Macs are to work on. I gave a lecture on the basis of the fact, and I said that if it seems hard, that means you're doing it wrong. Well, I should make the disclaimer right now that the iBook is the exception that proves the rule. It's crazy. The good news is that Apple saw their evil ways, and the new MacBook is so easy to work on. It's literally less than a minute to pull the hard disk out of it. I believe there's a screw. You remove the battery, you remove one screw, you take this little plate off, and then there's a little piece of plastic, and you slide the disk out into your hand. Oh, it's sweet. I put a link on the video showing that from YouTube that shows just how easy it is if you don't believe me. All right, back to our saga. I figured I might as well buy a notebook drive that's already in an enclosure. That way I could put the old 30 gig drive in the enclosure after I'm done, and I'd have a nice little external drive for backups or transferring video or something. I checked around for instant gratification on buying the notebook drive. Had to have it now. And most of the good deals at CompUSA and Best Buy were sold out or they were online only and had to be delivered. So I took a chance and headed on over to Costco to see if they had anything, and I think I really lucked out. They had a 120-gigabyte Western Digital USB drive, wasn't FireWire, for $140. Remember, these are the little 2.5-inch drives. I know you can get like a terabyte for $8 if they're the big drives, but these are the little ones. So I grabbed that baby and hoofed it on up to Namdar's house. I won't do the entire blow-by-blow, but if you subtract goofing off time, Nam kept trying to keep focus and I kept trying to distract him, and 15 minutes for chowing down a quick lunch, the total time Nam spent disassembling and reassembling Lindsay's computers was a full 4 hours. I put some pics in the show notes, one of Namdar looking really happy about the whole experience, one of the really cool-looking heatsink, and a third one that's a close-up of the heatsink showing how there's a copper tube drawing liquid to the fans for cooling. Okay, so maybe only the hardcore geeks are going to like those pictures, but I thought they were cool. There was some good comedy along the way. Namdar gave me the incredible responsibility of getting the 120-gig drive out of the enclosure. That's the external one. I pulled, I pried, I squeezed, I pried some more, I twisted, and then I searched the internet for instructions on how to get it out. I never could find anything to tell me how to get it out, but I did find a few people saying, "How do you get this thing out of here?" So I finally just pried really hard until I finally just snapped off two of the plastic pieces that were holding it in place. Well, hey, I got the job done, didn't I? And the sad part was that I actually finished getting it out right at the moment Nam pulled the drive from the iBook. It's possible I don't focus as well as Nam does, but hey, it was really hard getting that out. It was hard. All right, so fast forward to the finish line. The new drive is in. We've taken 2 hours to get into it and 2 hours to back out and put everything together because you can't test it until you've got the whole darn thing back together. And I pop in the Tiger install DVD. It gets to the part where you're supposed to click on the hard drive on which you want to install. Only no hard drive shows up in the window. My heart stopped. Fear, dismay. Oh, no. At this point, Nam starts talking kind of about how he had a bit of trouble with the connector on the hard drive when I was off getting lunch and seemed to kind of pull away from the ribbon cable a bit, and he was kind of worried about it. My fear increased, head in hands, mind swirling at how I'll be able to have to explain to my husband why I end up spending the night away from home because we have another 4 hours to put the old one back in. And then I thought, hey, maybe I should launch Disk Utility to see if it would be able to find the disk. Huzzah, the disk was there. Yay! The only problem was that it was formatted in Windows FAT32 format. Let me explain for a second what that means. It turns out there's only one format that can be read and written to by both Macs and PCs, and it's called FAT32. It's convenient to have a format for both, and that's how they can sell a disk drive and say it works for the Mac or the PC, but unfortunately it has a couple of major limitations. For one, you can't have files bigger than 4 GB, which seemed pretty large till video came around. I mean, you know, good video files, 20, 30 gig while you're working on it. The other big problem with it is that there's a 32-character file name limitation. Again, this doesn't seem too bad. Who names anything that long? But it turns out the length of the name includes every character in the name of the enclosing folders. So if you have a file maybe three or four folders deep on your disk, you could have a file that can't be transferred to a FAT32 drive. All right, that tech lesson aside, the wonderful news is that at this point, I was able to erase and format the drive to the Mac HFS format. And then the Tiger installed DVD could see the drive, and I was able to get it up and running. Yay! Many high fives between Nam and I, let me tell you. So when I got home, I connected the external drive that now has her old disk in it, and I launched what's called the OS X Migration Assistant. This assistant is awesome. It let me move all of her home directory, including all of her settings for her applications and her bookmarks and that sort of stuff, and all of her applications. Took a little bit over an hour, and her machine was almost there. I did have one brain fart when I created the first account during the OS install. My daughter's account was called Lindsay on the old drive, so I called the fresh install account Lindsay too. But then when I went to migrate her user account, I realized I'd have two accounts with the same name, which I was sure it wouldn't let me do. While I thought this was catastrophic, turns out the migration assistant has one of the options to replace the account with the same name. All right. One thing I screwed up but never saw coming was that her Mac's authorization to iTunes was on that drive, so I now have two authorizations and no idea how to get the other one off. I put the little 30 gig drive in the enclosure, so I suppose I might be able to boot off it. Not sure. Probably could. Then I could deauthorize that quote-unquote computer. I never thought of a disk as a computer. I guess that's the way they do it. I just assumed they did it by the Ethernet MAC address or something, because that's truly unique to each machine. I know I could deauthorize all, but Apple only lets you do that once a year, or so they say. You probably have to call and beg them. But it's not worth screwing with that anyway, because she only has two so far, and you can have five. That's going to bug me later. I'm going to not be able to figure out where that thing is, though. Finally, I ran software update to get all the security updates, and then I fixed disk permissions, and she was 100% back online. Oh, I should say, you know that thing I told you about, that hack called iScroll2 that lets you scroll with two fingers using an old iBook? That did not run right. She had to download and reinstall it again. But that was it. It was a really interesting experience. I enjoyed it. It was fun watching Namdar do it. And now, you know what? She has a bigger hard disk than I do. I had to delete a copy of CentOS in order to make the podcast today. I wonder what Nam's doing next weekend. Well, we're all becoming crazy with photography and video, posting to YouTube and Flickr and all that. But what if you could create a photo and video montage online, adding music and transition effects all through the web and for free, and to be able to share it with your friends and family? Enter OneTrueMedia at OneTrueMedia.com. At OneTrueMedia, you upload photos and videos, lay them out in the order you like, clip the videos easily to capture just the parts you like, and you can even add music from their list or upload your own MP3s. When you're finished, you can email a link to OneTrueMedia's site where your video montage lives, or you can take the code they give you to embed the video in your blog, sort of like the way YouTube does it, only higher quality. Well, I was distracted at first when I went in because there's so many options beyond what I describe here that you can only get through their premium service, which is either $3.99 a month or $40 for the full year. You think about $40 isn't that bad. Well, let's get started. First, you create a free login with your email address and a password. Next, click on Create a Montage and choose one of the four free settings, which are pretty plain grayscale kind of a look. With the premium service, you have a lot more choices like wedding, baby, our vacation, my band, that kind of thing. Next, you click Pick Theme. This really confused me for a while because I think they intermix the word setting and theme, so I thought I was doing a second operation, and I wasn't sure if I'd finished the first, but it's really your way of saying, yeah, I want to go with the setting I just picked. That stuck me for quite a while. I went away and left it for a week and came back and then figured out that's what they meant. Now you can name your montage and give it a description. Time to upload some files, video and photos, or if you already have some up there, you can work for those. It uploaded fairly quickly. I clicked done, and now I have a whole bunch of fun choices. Strangely, the first choice in the list is not to sequence and edit your photos and videos, but rather to share it and post it online, buy a DVD of your creation, or to download it to your iPod or to a QuickTime movie. Obviously, we have to skip past these to sequence and edit. This is where the beauty of the interface comes out. I uploaded a very short video, but I wanted to clip it from there. They gave me a set of photos in the video I'd selected, and if I hovered over the video, a choice of clip this video came up. I clicked on it, and then I saw my video with a representation of all the frames. I hovered over the frame where I wanted to start, and two buttons came up on screen right there, start and end. I clicked start, then I went to the last frame where I wanted it to end, and I clicked on end, and then save, and my video was ready. Very easy and intuitive. Never seen anything that good. Really, really slick. At this point, you can click on each photo and change how long it lasts, how it would transition from a fairly limited set of transitions like fade and push, a couple other things. You can also have, essentially like the Kevin Burns effect, that's where the photo's up on screen, it sort of zooms in a bit real slowly, or it kind of slides across the screen to give you the feeling of motion. You can now select music to add to the track, and on the video, you can choose whether to have the music and video tracks play at the same time, which is really annoying, or to pick one of the other sounds to override. You can preview your montage now, and then save and share. I grabbed the HTML they supplied me for my short video, and I've posted it in the blog to share, and you can see how it looks. I actually used the pictures of Nam and the MacBook and then stuck in this weird video that my son made when we were down in the Caribbean, so it doesn't make any sense, but you'll get the idea. I was jealous when I did finally set it up to go online because the premium plan had a lot other cool ways to make it look, like a little retro orange TV, but you had to pay the $40, so I didn't do it. Check it out in the show notes. I promise the video is not too long. And check out this fun tool at onetruemedia.com. Listener Neil sent in one of those websites that you just have to pass along to your friends, but which provides no technical value whatsoever. It's called Elgoog, and it's available at elgoog.rb.hosting.de. I'm sorry, it was a dash. elgoog.rb-hosting.de. To put it quite simply, it's Google spelled backwards. But it's actually Google backwards, not just spelled backwards, literally. When you go to Elgoog, you see what looks like Google, only everything is spelled backwards. That's mildly clever, but it gets more entertaining when you start to do searches. I should caution that when you're in Google, a carriage return selects the search button on the left, called Google Search, and you have to actively choose the I'm Feeling Lucky button. But on Elgoog, of course, the buttons are reversed, so if you put in a search term and you hit the carriage return, you'll get the functionality of I'm Feeling Lucky instead. Of course, it's spelled backwards, and I'm not even going to try to begin to pronounce what I'm Feeling Lucky is spelled like backwards. As you type your search term into Elgoog, it spells it forwards for you, but on the right-hand side, and then it executes a search for the term backwards. Well, there's a good opportunity to test my podcast. I typed in Allison and hit a carriage return, which took us to nocilla.com. Sadly, that is not my domain, but another Allison got to it first. You'd be surprised how many Allisons have used Nocilla. Must be something wrong in our brains. But don't be fooled by imitators, though. Don't stay at that site and look around. As I said, this site, Elgoog, has no redeeming value unless you find silliness as redeeming as I do. Thanks, Neil, for the silly tip. I want to end the show with a wonderful gift I was given from one of our listeners. Ryan Sakamoto from GraphicForce.net created a beautiful logo for use on my website. It sort of looks like an audio player, but it keeps in the sort of turquoise green of my blog. It brings out the pod feet into two pudgy-looking real, you know, feet-colored feet, oriented the same as my logo. And it says NoSillaCast with Allison Sheridan from podfeet.com. I am in love with this artwork. It is so cool. Let me read you his letter. Allison, I really love your podcast show and look forward to each and every episode. I took the liberty of designing a logo for your podcast. If you like it, it's yours to keep and use any way you want to, no charge, of course. Just my way of saying mahalo for your efforts. Keep up the great work. I got to give props to all the podcasters out there for their continued efforts of producing each and every podcast. I know it's a ton of work. Ryan, I can't thank you enough for taking so much time to make such a wonderful gift. I absolutely love it. My plan is to try to make a Flash player to embed in the site, or maybe use QuickTime, and make the new artwork the skin for the player. Wouldn't that be cool? You got to get a look at it over on the website. I did a preview of it so you can see it, but it doesn't have any functionality yet. If I get 30 seconds to myself to not do something for somebody else, I'm going to learn how to do that Flash player thing. I think that'd be awesome. He also made a new Now Playing logo that's really cool. Shows a MacBook with iTunes in the background, and it's got my face in the bottom left-hand corner of the iTunes, and it's kind of coming out of, my face is coming out of the screen, and then it has the fat little feet on the bottom. It's really cool, too. I got to decide whether I'm going to use that one. He suggested that maybe I could use it as the album artwork that shows up in iTunes. That might be fun, too. Be sure to head on over to his website at graphicforce.net and look at the wonderful work he does. I know I've said it before, but it has never been more true than right now. When people ask me what keeps me doing all this for free, I have to say it's the feedback I get from my listeners that make it worth 150% worth my time. Thank you to all who continue to support me in this. I look forward to hearing even more from more of you. As always, you can email me at allison@podfeet.com or send me a voice recording at nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.